This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Justice Clarence Thomas says Supreme Court confirmation hearings should be less intrusive and more brief. The Republican-controlled Senate blocks the Democrats' efforts to pressure the president into withdrawing troops from Iraq, and black legislators demand that FEMA release the names of people displaced by hurricanes. In New York, we've got Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. From Boston, Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, and at NPR West in Culver City, California, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. Thank you all for joining me. And let me jump right in. I remember a certain cover, George Curry, of a certain magazine called Emerge with a certain lawn jockey that looked remarkably like Clarence Thomas. What do you think of his declaration now that you should soft pedal the confirmation hearings?
Well, I mean, that wasn't the only cover we had. We also had one of him with an entomologist nod on his head, and so I have no regrets about those. I think they were quite appropriate for him. Listen, he's talking about there being a narrow test, a litmus test on abortion. That's really not the case. The litmus test for being appointed to federal judicial appointments is that you be conservative, that you be against abortion, that you be against affirmative action, and that you have extreme far-right support. That's the litmus test, not an abortion.
Kelly, what about you?
You know, what I think is interesting is that as long as people that are being supported by the right are being attacked, then that's a problem. But if in the same way it was happening on the other side, then we wouldn't hear much. Abortion is definitely something that's a litmus test for the far right. I mean, that's the reason Harriet Meyer's nomination went down eventually, one of the big reasons, because they couldn't be quite sure. And so with the new guy, Alito, it's quite clear by his writings what he thinks about it. And, you know, that's the bottom line. So I think Clarence Thomas doth protest too much.
Walter, let me ask you. Alito apparently made statements quite a while back saying that he did not think that there was any inherent right to abortion. Should that mean that people on the left should vigorously oppose his nomination, or should there be a more even flow of opinion on the court?
Well, I don't think it should be that singular test. I think all nominees to the federal bench should come under extreme scrutiny, particularly those who are selected to serve on the Supreme Court. Remember, these are lifetime appointments. Many of these people will serve for over two decades on the court. So I think we have to make sure that we scrutinize all nominees, and it should not be on a single issue.
Let me tell you a little bit more about the situation with Alito. We are looking at a situation now where the right has been vociferously protesting about certain nominees not being committed enough to protesting abortion. Now the left is going to have its turn at Alito. How long do you think, Walter, that this situation will go on with both sides really jockeying over abortion as the key issue?
Well, I think it's going to go on for a while. Remember, we're talking about the balance of the court is at stake. This is a person that replaces Sandra Day O'Connor. So this is a very intense battle because Roe versus Wade is the case that many people think will turn if the court becomes more conservative. So abortion has risen to the top, but I would say that we have to be careful because there are a number of issues that we should be concerned about far beyond abortion, and to restrict ourselves to one issue and scrutinizing a nominee, I think could backfire against us, particularly the African-American community.
I think it's interesting that George Bush always says he opposes activist judges, but there was a study done by a professor at Yale that was reprinted in the New York Times that showed when you really break down the court, the ones who are most conservative are the ones who voted more often to overturn laws that Congress passed legitimately. So if you're talking about activist judges, those are the conservatives, but the conservatives have won the PR war because they've done a better job of framing the issue.
Let me turn to another issue. We have FEMA not having released the list of people displaced by hurricanes. And at this point, there are families of children, arguably thousands of children, still looking for their parents. Do you think that, Callie, that FEMA needs to do more in terms of trying to reunite these families?
I do think that FEMA needs to do more to reunite the families, but I am queasy about what the legislators want to do, the 17 senators and representatives from Louisiana asking FEMA for a list of the people displaced by the hurricane. And that's on a privacy issue. On the one hand, I'm quite nervous that, you know, FEMA does the right thing. On the other hand, I just see this information floating around in all kinds. Oh, that's a bad analogy. Going around in many places where it ought not be. And once people get a hold of your private information, then there it goes every place where it shouldn't be. And it's not for the purpose that people articulate it. So while I am quite concerned about the joining together of those families, there ought to be a way in which we can work or FEMA can work to do that without trying to invade the privacy of those people.
And let me ask you, George, is it possible to have a full exploration of where people have gone without some kind of invasion of privacy? Isn't it, certainly at this point, I think Callie's analogy to the war on terror is actually quite apt. We have arguably sacrificed some degree of privacy in order to have a fuller accounting of where people go, theoretically, to make us safer. But, in this case, we're really talking about families that have been divided. Are you willing to sacrifice a certain amount of privacy to get those families reunited?
Well, like Callie, I have mixed feelings. One is anytime a politician wants a list of anything, I have reservations. But the point here is twofold. One is, yes, there are certain privacy issues. But the other thing is, people are taking public money here. People are lost. And I don't see where the disclosure of that names, not all the pertinent information, but that names, I don't see that how that really violate their privacies. If these are people who in need, who still need additional care, and I don't see this, how the disclosure of that name really violate their privacy.
Walter?
I would agree. I mean, I think the bigger issue is FEMA itself. You know, they've set December 1st as a target date to turn people out of hotels that they've been funding, and we're talking 53,000 families. I think there's a serious problem, ongoing problem, with the management of this crisis. So I would really have no confidence in this agency to do much to help these people. I think the disclosure of names would certainly help in terms of trying to bring some families back together, which I think is critical, because at some point you have to bring some normalcy back into the lives of these people. They're drifting right now. So I think the disclosure of names would be a good thing, but I think we all should be concerned about how FEMA has been operating since the hurricane hit that area.
And maybe what needs to happen in this case is that there is some oversight by another organization, another agency, somebody, to watch how they do it. I think it's critical that there be some reconnecting with the families, but let's just see how they move the information around. That would be, I think, something important to pay attention to.
Let me ask a question that might be a little bit more theoretical. It seems as if in the evacuation process, they could have done a much better job of accounting for the families, where they have gone. What kind of provisions should the government make to change its policy so that if something like this ever happens again, people can be accounted of as they are leaving the location they're evacuating? Kelly.
Well, I will never forget looking at people boarding buses. There's no names taken. People handing over children. It's a miracle that any of these people were able to connect again. I mean, this is just fundamental. You know, in an elementary school, people take names when folks go on field trips. This was crazy. I've never seen anything like it. So at the base, there should have been somebody there with a clipboard taking down some names. And then we can move up from there.
George. I would go beyond the clipboard. I would say we have the technology right now. There's no excuse for this. There can be a centralized list. People can have access through the computer and know where people are up to the moment. That's a simple way of doing it. It's not that complicated.
Walter?
Well, I think there's got to be better coordination between the federal and state and local governments. You know, clearly the people who knew their community best were on the ground, and I think there's got to be better coordination with federal agencies when a disaster strikes, because what we saw happen in New Orleans was just mass chaos. There was no plan in that city for this type of catastrophe when they knew all along that they were susceptible to this type of, you know, Category 4 storm. So I think it's a coordination issue also in terms of how you handle a crisis of that magnitude.
Let me move on to George.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
All right. I just wanted to move on to one more topic. This is something that any of you who have children is probably going to be interested in. There is the fact that at this point, college tuition, both private and public college tuition, is skyrocketing. And so a new report asks, where is the money going? One place is into the pockets of the college presidents. Some of them in the private sector are pulling down more than $1 million a year as payment. Now, of course, they have a very complicated job. They are acting in some ways as part babysitter, part educator, part fundraiser. But at this point, in the same way that CEO compensations were scrutinized, should we be looking at college compensations for presidents? And should public colleges, on the other hand, be getting more money for their presidents? Arguably, theirs is even a tougher job since most of these public colleges are even bigger. Callie, what do you think about the explosion in compensation for college presidents? Is it fair?
It's certainly not fair, but, you know, this is what private industry does. Whatever the market will bear. Some of the reasoning is that their colleges are trying to get people who have already been presidents. And so when they move from being one president to another campus, they're able to raise their fee. It's exactly what you see in private industry across the board. So, of course, it's not fair. At a time when public universities are having their budget slashed for resources that need to go to students. I mean, that's if there's going to be some more money pumped into public universities, it ought to be going to students. Then I can't really get too whipped up about the salaries of public university presidents.
Well, I think we have to make sure that we make a distinction here between public and private. The $1 million contracts are all at private universities. The highest public one is at the University of Michigan, which is $724,000. Look, these college presidents are still making less than football coaches, by far. I see nothing wrong with them making the money. I just hope some of it filters down to the professors as well and also the students. But when you put things in perspective and look at corporate America, they're really not that outrageous.
You know, I'd have to agree with George. You know, you have to make a distinction between the private and public institutions, because oftentimes the larger private research-oriented institutions, education is just, you know, one of the things that those institutions actually do. Some of them, the bigger ones that have these billion-dollar endowments, they're really asset managers. I mean, they are moving billions of dollars worth of money. So I think for a salary to be $750 to $1 million for the head of a private major research institution, that's not too outlandish. I think we should be concerned when the public sector salaries begin to outpace, you know, the tuition, because we have a problem at public schools where some of these public schools now, the tuition is beginning to creep up so high that they're not able to serve the very population that they're supposed to serve. So I think in the public sector, we really have to keep an eye on it.
Well, let me follow up with you, Walter. There has been a virtual flatlining of the resources that go to college students. The Pell Grant program, for example, has been flat funded for 3 years, which means that although the costs are rising, the amount of money that is available to your kind of typical student is really not rising that much. At this point, our government is stressed on many fronts. You've got the Katrina recovery. You have the war in Iraq. What can this government, or should this government, offer to everyday students who want to better themselves in terms of funding from the federal government?
Well, I think there should be greater financial assistance, because at some point in time, this is going to backfire on this nation, because our intellectual capital will be affected. I think you got to invest in young people who want to pursue higher learning. And for most young people, that's going to be through a public institution. So I think we work against ourselves when we don't make that investment. The other thing that's happening is that we're burdening too many of these young people with tremendous debt, because now they're being turned over and they have to go to get a student loan. And you're seeing loans pile up where people are leaving these schools, sometimes $25,000, $30,000 in debt, which travels with them for some time as they're trying to begin their careers, many of them trying to start families. So I think we need to recommit to this notion that investing in young people is investing in our future.
I think that's the critical issue. The critical issue is that over the years, we have shifted from grants to loans, and that's why students have all that debt to go with it. We need to go back and start saying we are really committed to education, and not just in words, but in deed.
Kelly, how's that going to happen when the government is just literally so strapped for money?
You have to make choices. There's always going to be a limited amount of resources, and choices have to be made. I mean, at a time when we're looking at a deficit that's going to be carried by these young people by the time they get to be the age of some of us now, you got to make some choices about investing in that intellectual capital, as Walter said. I mean, somebody in those classrooms could figure out how a system by which we would never end up in a Katrina scenario again. Somebody in those classrooms could figure out some of the science that is critical for us to figure out how to live on this planet. That's just an investment you cannot put aside. So in terms of reallocating limited resources, this has to go high, high, high up on the list.
Walter, let me just, you know, take what Callie said about Katrina and frame it in a very personal sense. When I was down in Louisiana, I met these young men who were making $8 an hour cleaning out hotel rooms. And they were folks who didn't really have jobs before. So for them, the $8 an hour job is a good job, but they were all smart young men. They all could have, you know, gone and gotten higher education if they had the somebody championing them and the money to do it. How important is it in light of some of the socioeconomic issues that Katrina raised to really reemphasize higher education?
Oh, it's very important. And we can't forget the fact that we have lost two treasured historically black colleges, Dillard and Xavier. I mean, those schools were devastated by Katrina in a city that desperately needs more educated young black people in order to strengthen the local economy. So we can't lose sight of the fact that education is critical and that unless we make that investment in education, we're all going to be affected because the nation's economy eventually, our growth will be retarded because you'll see what the global economy is all about when you have young people from another country sort of being able to compete at a level that our kids can.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. In New York, Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. And from NPR West in Culver City, California, we had George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. I want to thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My love is hard.